When I was younger, I was always thinking that it was something wrong with me, why I didn't really felt that I was fitting in. And after I've grown older and like more experienced, I realized that it is because the environment is not always very inclusive, and especially not if you are different. Like I tried to like create a road for euphonium that doesn't exist.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman, which I hope inspires you through the personal stories of a fascinating diversity of musical guests. I'm excited to feature Bente Illevold, the internationally renowned Norwegian euphonium player who's carved out a unique career path as a euphonium virtuoso. During this podcast, you'll be hearing clips from some of her albums and live performances, and in the complete show notes on my website, you'll find the links to these specific albums and videos. I first heard about Bente from Catherine Needleman when she asked Bente to premiere a newly commissioned concert piece for euphonium and piano by Kyrese Washington. Bente will be playing the American premiere of this new work at the International Women's Brass Conference right after the release of this podcast in May 2025, and the clip you're going to hear is from the world premiere performance earlier this spring. Bente talked to me about her exciting new Rendlin low brass seminar and ways to address the problems around inclusivity in the low brass world. She also spoke more broadly about music pedagogy and the importance of careful listening and self-reflection, and she stressed the need for authenticity in engaging with our listeners. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube channel or listen to the podcast on many podcast platforms, and I've also linked the transcript to my website, leahroseman.com. It's a joy to bring these inspiring episodes to you every week, and I do all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. Have a look at the description of this episode, where you'll find timestamps and all the links, including different ways to support this podcast.
Hello, thanks so much for joining me here today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you're the first euphonium player I've had on the series. And I know that many brass players will be listening, but, you know, I'm a violinist, and I was talking to our principal trumpet player, Karen Donnelly, who was an early guest of this podcast, and she was saying how the sound of the euphonium is so different from the trombone because, and she used all these terms I didn't understand. So maybe, could we start with the euphonium and why it's not used in orchestra very much and why it's such a great solo instrument?
That's a big question, you know, and I don't have like the answer to that question, I think, but I can like talk about it the way I see it. And I think it's just like when the valve system was developed on brass instrument, it's like there were like desperate need for a big brass instrument that could play chromatically, you know, so the tuba automatically got a space in the orchestra. And for the euphonium, I don't know. I think it's just people that play that horn on that in that time probably didn't have like wasn't on the barricade working for the instrument, I suppose. That's the only like main reason I think it's not in the orchestra. It should belong there in the brass section, I think. And of course some composers know that and has written for it historically, and I don't really have an answer to why it's not an orchestra instrument. It should be, but I think maybe this is the problem we are facing in the world of euphonium. I guess we'll come to that later in the podcast, but it's like we haven't really established us as an important instrument on the classical scene of music or the music scene in classical music. And that's a problem we are struggling with today, I think, both when it comes to like people acknowledging performers as great artists. We have some like really world-class players around the globe on euphonium that I think is not any less so soloist than a big violinist or a big trumpet player, but still the euphonium struggle to like sort of gain the respect I think it's neat in the world of classical music. And yeah, I think it has some qualities that no other brass instruments has really. So to me, it's like a diamond that is not really discovered by everyone yet.
Yeah, and you're certainly doing a lot to to further the renown of the instrument. Now, I found out about you through Catherine Needleman, so I hope many people know who she is who are listening, and I did feature her on the podcast a few months ago, and I'll have that episode linked. So she commissioned a piece by Kyries Washington that you recently premiered as we record this. It's really beautiful, and thanks for sending me that preview of the premiere. Are you planning on recording it anytime soon?
It depends on funding. It always comes down to that. I think in this business, it's like time and money. That's our big concern. So I have applied for some funding and hope that we will get it so we can record it with the pianist Monica that I did the premiere with.
It's really beautiful. So I'm hoping we can include a clip for people to listen to a little bit of it from that performance.
Oh, sure, sure, absolutely. And it will be a US premiere in May because I'm going to the IWBC, the International Women's Brass Conference in Hartford. And I have programmed it on my recital there as well. So
when is that conference?
It's between the... I think it's from the 21st to 25th of May.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the International Women's Brass Conference. That was on my list of things. How important is this for you as an organization?
I think it's super important. And this is a very big question. And I don't know like how you are going into it, but like to be a female brass player or especially be a female low brass player, and it's a big question again, but for me it's like I first went to the IWBC in I think it was 2017 when it was in New Jersey, and I never felt so welcome at any festival ever, and that was sort of that's what I was like hoping for and probably like struggle with for a long time in my career when I was young and a student as well. It's like to find a place you feel that you belong or that people like genuinely care about you, and it's not just like a competitive environment all the time. And I found that there, and yeah, and I think it's a very like warm and inclusive atmosphere at the conferences, and yeah, that I really really enjoy being a part of. And I think it's a very a big need for that kind of environment in our community. Mm-hmm. So will you be meeting Kyries, the composer, when you go to the States on this next trip? I hope so. They said that they will be at the that recital, or at least will try to come. So I really hope so. Yeah.
So Kairiz is a flute player and composer. And I was thinking, I mean, there are some similarities between the flute, even though it's so much higher, but the kind of fluidity you can achieve on the instruments.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, but it comes down to the like ideal on how you want to sound as well on the euphonium, and like what kind of qualities you put on your top priority list in your playing. And I think what is super cool about the euphonium, at least the way I see it still, is that we don't have globalized sound. We still have very different ways of playing this instrument depending on where you're from, actually. We have like a very specific American tradition on the euphonium, a very British one, and maybe sort of a Nordic one, and then I would call it like a Central or South Europe one. That's like the main in the Western world main, and those styles are very, very different, and focuses on very different qualities. And for me, it's like my top priority is always in my playing is the sound. And if you don't have a great sound, you have nothing, in my opinion. And then it's like what you call the, you just refer to like the flow or the flexibility, the ability to just like play very fluently. But at the same time, it's very a lot hard to do that on euphonium, because the if you listen really carefully, you can hear a lot of playing out there that is not really well centered. So it's just like, I can say it's like it's very easy to cheat on the euphonium as well. I will say, to be honest, I think it's like it's euphonium is a pretty easy instrument to get to a certain level on. It's like, yeah, when you start playing, probably, honestly, in my opinion, euphonium and saxophone is probably the easiest instrument to start on, and but to like come really good is of course hard. But I think, yeah. You can fake it, and it can still sound pretty good for those who are not trained to really listen on euphonium, in my opinion.
Yeah. In Kairiz's Sonatina de Larmes, the Sonatina of Tears, you premiered it in a part of a program that you called She Sounds Like a Girl.
Yeah.
Because this is what we hear.
Yeah, and that's like been... It's been a long process for me to really, as I said earlier, to like, I struggle a lot with like finding my spot or like finding a community. I felt I belong. And when I was younger, I was always thinking that it was something wrong with me, why I didn't really felt that I was fitting in. And after I've grown older and like more experienced, I realized that it is because the environment is not always very inclusive, and especially not if you are different. Like I try to like create a road for euphonium that doesn't exist. And the strange thing is that though I have a lot of support also on my field by other euphonium players, I also meet a lot of resistance from other euphonium players that doesn't like the way I speak about the instrument or the way I play it or what I play. I'm playing a lot of music that not so many other people play. I came to this conclusion when I was in my master's. It's about 10 years ago now. And I realized that, like, why try to, like, okay, if you're going to, like, trying to make a career on the global scene, global brass scene, then why try to play the same pieces that everyone else play? And, like, it all comes down to, like, taste or like what do you it will be like it's an impossible discussion to like talk about who's really the best, you know. It will always come down to taste. It's like who's the world's best violinist or a trumpet player. It's impossible to like decide. And it's the same with euphonium player. But then I decided like I just want to like leave footprints that nobody else has left before. And I think that's also for me, that is also like, it's about having an artistic mindset that has to be creative. And like, if you look down the music history, it's like people that have really made a change and isn't the people that just follow the crowd. It's like you have to, as an artist, I feel you have the responsibility to also provoke, not only like do what the rest is doing and play the same pieces or work on your excerpts. I think it's like we really need, and especially on the brass scene, in my opinion, because I find it a bit conservative, to be honest, we really need people that are, playing in a different way, doing different repertoire, being more crazy. I think we really need that and take risk. I think it's like to achieve something great, you have to go outside the comfort zone. Like great things has never happened inside the comfort zone, like on any field in the world, I think.
Yeah. I was thinking about your duo with the percussionist. What's his name?
Anders Kregnes Hansen.
Mm-hmm. So you've done quite a few projects. You have an album. Do you want to speak to that collaboration?
Yeah, and we are having great plans for the future now, and we have a lot of new music waiting for us to premiere and record a new album. Hopefully it will be done in 2026, both a lot of new pieces and record an album. And yeah, that is like, I really find that some of the qualities when I spoke about sound earlier is like to play with percussion is really, the euphonium can really shine there, and you can really be challenged as an artist to try to blend with all the different percussion sounds. And you have this enormous palettes of sound that you can create, and that is like, I really, really enjoy that. And it's like really, yeah, it takes a lot for me, and it's really hard. Anders is a really, really, really good musician, and it's, I really need to be on top of my game to do that, and I really enjoy those challenges, yeah, playing with him, and trying to make some. There has been, of course, several percussion, and there is percussion and euphonium duo still also in the US, quite good one. But it's like doing big, serious repertoire and like creating new stuff. Again, it comes down to that, and like really, really leave your mark. And that is what Anders and I'm trying to do. And we're really, really lucky that we got actually what it is called ensemble support from them. Norwegian state this year, so then that's also like a great achievement that they noticed our work and really appreciate the diversity we bring into the Norwegian music scene.
Mm-hmm. I was hoping we could include a clip from some of what you've recorded with them, like you have the latest album with music of I can't pronounce these names.
Stig Nordhagen.
There we go. Do you would that be okay to include something for people to hear?
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. So I think it's, I think you can include something from the Euphonium Concerto, the trio with the piano and Anders, or you can also include some with the string players. I think the second movement, especially from the main title piece, Baut, is really, really cool.
Yeah.
And also a lot about the coloring and, yeah. You really don't know what instruments that are playing at some points on that. And
thank you.
And I also want to like add in that for me, it's recording is a cool, it's very cool to do an album, and it's sort of like it's the modern portfolio or CV, we can say now. It's like your album that's really like your statement, but at the same time, it's like we all know that albums are fake. It's like it's a lot of the big companies are like the edits are so enormous. It's like I asked when Anders and I recorded our first album, I asked the producer like, how many cuts do you usually have? And then he said it was like, yeah, usually 1500 cuts on 1 hour music at least. And all like the mastering and like sound edits and yeah, different things. But this latest album, and also my solo album that is not completely on streaming platform, the COVID album, Alena, is like recorded on a different company. It's called Authentic Recordings. And that's a young producer and a very, very small record label from in Oslo. And the philosophy is to have authentic recordings. And the philosophy is like you record a whole piece three times. And then if you don't have everything, you do like small takes, maybe like 20 bars. And that's it. Because it's like, and I think at some point you will enjoy that because you get a feeling of the intensity that you really have. If it was a concert and you still have the possibility to get everything pretty right, but it's not like fixed. Because, and I think it's like, we are so trained now, we are expecting perfection, but I'm not sure if I like that. Recording perfection is really art. It's fascinating and sort of entertaining, but I'm not sure if it's the art. And like, if everything is going to be that way, I think we will like the live concert and the live experience of being together as humans will disappear gradually. And we really, really need that. And in the world and how everything is developing now, I find that like, like, I ask myself constantly, like, how did we come to this, you know, this point of everything in the global situation politically and everything where we are now? And I find that the reason is because we don't meet each other, we don't talk to each other, we don't experience things together as a big community anymore. It's like all individual by your own, watching your phone or watching something on your TV instead of like actually being present with other people talking or experience things. And I don't know how it's like other places in the world, but after COVID, still concert scenes or like orchestras struggle to get audience here in Norway. Mm. So it's like it's still hard because people have like just gone into their own, like zoomed into their own lives. And I think that's, we need to like leave the phone at home and go out and be together and be present. And I think also to be an artist is like completely necessary to be connected to the society you're a part of. I think as an artist, you are obligated to like have an opinion on what's going on around you, because art has always been a reflection on the society in the present time. And if you don't leave that behind, if you just like try to look good on a video or sound good on something that is recorded 1,000 times and edit, it's like, it's not the same.
Yeah, I agree with you.
We are losing humanity, sort of. Yeah. In the arts. Yeah. Yeah.
I do get the feeling where I am in Canada. I mean, the audiences that have come back are maybe different than before, but there's a hunger to be together and experience things live. So hopefully elsewhere, especially if people can get new and younger audiences in the halls, that's a way forward, I think.
I hope you're right.
Yeah. I hear these trends. They were really starting before the pandemic with all the online behavior, like movie theaters, you know, who goes to movies? Like very few people anymore. Used to be such a thing. So yeah, I think it is a challenge for all the performing arts. And I guess visual art, I mean, even like going to galleries, you know, people go when they're tourists, I think, you know, they visit a place or they go to a famous gallery, but in their own city, maybe not so many people. go and experience art that way. What do you think?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's like, I often hear people say they like struggle to relax or like get some time to rest. But I think it's like, to do that, you need to like, just don't stay at home or watch your phone. You need to like be out there and like have your brain focus on something else. I think that is important. I'm not saying I'm super good at it myself, but it's like I see the need of being with people and having conversations with people instead of just, yeah, living off social media. Yeah, I have like a huge presence on social media myself, but I get asked a lot about that because people seem to think that since I am present on social media, I also spend a lot of time on social media. But that is like very, very different, two very different things. So so I use it for work, but I still try to make it real. I think it's like, it's also a part of the problem also for the younger generation students. They are getting like unrealistic thoughts on how it is. It's like, it's not glamorous. I'm not living a glamorous life to be, even if I'm a euphonium player traveling a lot around doing a lot of stuff, is like, my life is not glamorous. I don't think it will ever be for a euphonium player. Honestly, I not in my lifetime, at least. Maybe I can do something that will help that in 100 years somebody can be a real true rock star on the euphonium. But it's like, to create that illusion that your life is glam as a like world star is like, yeah, I don't like that approach to social media. I think it should be real. And yeah, I think that will be, then it could also be beneficial for students, and it could be like more for education and them for real learn instead of just getting like idols that they like want to be like. I see that tendency a lot when I travel around and teach. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I enjoyed watching a couple of your online masterclasses you did from your own studio where you presented fundamentals, and you know, as a violinist, I found it interesting. So I wanted to ask you about some of that, and I was thinking, oh yeah, you talked about how students need to have the patience for listening to for themselves and focusing on excellence in the basics. So I also wanted to ask you about your training and your path early on too.
Yeah, I started very late, at least in the Norwegian perspective. I started playing piano when I was really young, and then I started playing the trumpet in the school band. Wasn't really good, so I switched to euphonium when I was around 15. And I'm born and raised in a very, very small town, well, not really a town, but more of a county in the middle of nowhere, I will say. So it was very far from any city and any professional ensemble of any kind. So I grew up, the music I heard live was basically folk music and band on a not so very high level, very low level where I came from. And so I didn't really have anything to, and this was of course before YouTube and everything, you know, so I didn't have the access to listen to excellence. So I had to work very hard. I don't know about Canada, but I know about US education system is very, very different than in Norway. And in Norway, it's very hard, at least. And still, for some instruments, very hard to get into school. You need to have really high level. Everything is based as a conservatory, not as a college. So the music education here. So we're going into performance bachelor degree. It's very, very hard. And when I was accepted at the Norwegian Academy of Music in Oslo, it was like 4 years since they last accepted a euphonium player into the school in bachelor's. And I had to like audition 3 times to get in, 3 years. So I was like 21, I think, when I started my bachelor. And I had to work super hard, because I didn't have the training in young age. And when I started, it was like my teacher put me on the fundamental school. And like, it was super, super hard, because I had to do mostly basic and fundamentals. I practiced probably 3-4 hours a day, that's sort of the limit you can do on a brass instrument, I feel, or and maybe someone can do more, but for me it's always been a limit around that time to not get any fatigue that will stick. Mostly on fundamentals, I almost didn't play any repertoire for those first 2 years. It was super hard because all my friends that were students as well, they played a lot of solos, and I didn't have anything ready when we were going to have masterclasses and stuff. But looking back, it was really good. It was really what I needed, and I feel like now it feels like a global trend, to be honest, that people are skipping that work and going to repertoire, starting maybe on high school, just working on repertoire and staying there and haven't really learned the fundamentals. And then, yeah, you've spent so much time learning the repertoire because it's actually, you don't have the skills, you're just learning one piece at the time. It's a very different pedagogic than an approach than I think you should learn to play the instrument. And then you have to always play repertoire on the level you are. The repertoire, in my opinion, is like the repertoire should always be easier than your fundamentals. Mm-hmm. So you have you have the sort of, yeah, you need to, I don't know the English word for this. You need to have energy and focus left to think about the musicality, sound, intonation, all that. And sometimes you hear, students just barely being able to come through their recital. And then, you haven't done your fundamentals, and it takes time, but it's like, we all know that. It's like 10,000 hours, right, of practice. That's not the minimum. Probably I have 20,000 now or even more. And that's just what it takes. And it's like, I don't have any talent, or I don't have any talent on the euphonium. I think I have, my family was, many people in my family on my father's side was musicians, or everybody played an instrument, and some of them pretty good for their time or for the place they were from. A lot of them went to Oslo and studied music. My siblings, or my grandfather, and also my grandfather. And now I think I can see that I sort of have a talent for phrasing or understanding or putting passion into my play. But I will say that it's only the last 5 years maybe I've been at a level where I really can use that ability. Before that, I wasn't good enough on the instrument, you know. So I don't think it's musicality isn't just to put in the instrument like that. If you don't really, your instrument need to be so automatic for you. So we don't really have to think what you're doing technically or physically. It just have to be there as a reflection. I tell that a lot to my students. Like, I feel playing the euphonium for me has been sort of a travel in real learning your basic instincts in the body, because you are doing so much that it's so not natural for the body, and you need to sort of relearn the body to not react in the natural way, but react in the way that is beneficial for the playing.
Could you be more specific about that? I'm curious where you're going.
It's very basic. For example, tensing up when you're out of breath, because that's very, very common. And when you tense up immediately, you will ruin your sound. So force yourself to stay calm. That's very working against your instincts, right? And also when you are super out of breath and you want to just take an inhale like that, you need to learn to take a deep breath automatically. That is your reaction. And when you're starting on a high note and it's very natural to tense up and aiming for the high note, you're still feeling grounded, working with your diaphragma. Yeah, a lot of physical stuff, I would say, to sort of relearn the body to do different things, mm-hmm, than what is natural for us. At least that I would say is it's been that way for me.
Yeah. Yeah. And about fundamentals, I mean, myself, I've been a professional violinist for over 30 years, and things I took for granted when I was younger, that I wouldn't lose these things, you need to relearn things, or things start to change in your technique. So I'm always, you know, reevaluating and working on basics for sure.
Yeah, and I feel it's like sometimes when I'm in sort of a hurry, or I have periods where I have so much repertoire that to get through everything in like 3 hours a day, I don't have so much time. I will do like 5-10 minutes warm up and then just go to the repertoire because it's needed. And I feel that those periods, I don't really get any better, or I'm not like developing like a healthy way of playing. And after a while, I feel like my fingers are sticking. And yeah, so always when I have the time, I do. Still today, for example, I do almost 1 hour of basic every morning. Start with that when I have the time. And especially when I'm on tour, because it's like I say to people, it's like when you're touring, that's when you lose the shape. You need to like work really hard to be in super good shape when you're starting a tour, because when you end the tour, your shape will be very bad. Because when you only played concerts, and that only takes things away from you, it doesn't give you anything, sort of, when it comes to we have this term in Norwegian, what we will say is like it's fresh made. You need to keep it fresh all the time. If you like leave it for a week, it will drop very, very fast.
Yeah, I can relate for sure.
I really want to say a few words about the Nocturno Lockdown Lullaby. If you have
It's so beautiful, yes.
Yeah, because you probably want to use something from that, I assume. Or I hope.
Yes.
Yeah. So I just want to say a few words about a piece that I'm very, very happy with, or like I'm very proud of being able to premiere. And it's a very beautiful piece written by a Norwegian composer named Markus Paus. He's one of the finest contemporary composers we have in Norway, and he is actually not very typical contemporary, not very experimental, but he is, really check out all his music. And this piece he wrote for me, the first he wrote for me, is called Nocturno Lockdown Lullaby, and it was written during lockdown, of course, during COVID. That was like, for me, I commission a lot of music, and I find it very like, it develops me a lot as a performer, because by learning new music, I learn also a lot about, when you ask another instrumentalist to write for you, I learn about their way of understanding written music. For example, I got music written from a clarinetist, or a carese as a flutist, or a percussionist. It's like their way of notating the music, and like their way of like understanding how it's written. It's very, very different from the different traditions of instruments. But Markus is a composer, and he was a guitar player. I think he played mostly like electric guitar. He has like never ever played a euphonium, but when I got that music, it was just playing the first phrase. It was like, I was like, he has catched the like main thing about the euphonium, like how the euphonium really can sound, or like how I wanted it to sound. And it's like, I don't know if that was because he has listened a lot to me earlier, or he has listened a lot to euphonium. I don't know. I haven't asked him. I should ask him about that. But he had really like, it was a spot on, like, this is the euphonium. This is the way it should be played, and like how the music should be. It was like perfectly written. And you know, it's like, I enjoy challenges in new repertoire, and I want it. I want to like expand the borders. I want to like, go into new land, breaking new ground, of course. But sometimes I get new pieces that I feel the composer hasn't written for me, or hasn't written for my instrument, has just written, you know what I mean? And when I commission, and in Norway we have, the composer has pretty good arrangements here in Norway, so I can apply for state funding for the composer, they get a lot of money, and I have to apply or will probably don't get so much money for to perform it or learn it. So it's very, very different. and we probably spend as much time as the composer. I will probably spend that many hours to learn it sometimes, and they get a lot of money and I ending up just getting paid for a concert. So, but that's the way it is. But, and then you feel at, sometimes I feel at least that they should like learn about me, and they should like pay any interest about the way I sound, the way I like to play the euphonium. And I don't know if Marcus did that, but it was like, for me, it's like school example on how to write for euphonium, like how to understand an instrument, like the craftsmanship of composing, I guess. It's like, yeah, and it's so, so beautiful, and you can hear it because it fits the instrument, and it's like, yeah, you can hear he had the euphonium in his head when he wrote it. And I think that's good composing, and we need more quality music of that kind for the euphonium, because we are getting a lot of repertoire for euphonium. We have so much repertoire, and I think like the euphonium is maybe one of the compared to like other brass instruments, I have a feeling that we commission a lot now, and we are expanding the repertoire so much. I don't necessarily feel that everything is of great quality. Mm-hmm. But this one is, for sure.
Well, thanks for that.
This live performance of Lockdown Lullaby is on Benta's YouTube channel. The video is linked in the complete show notes on my website. And Benta also recorded this piece on her first album, which you'll find linked as well.
Thank you.
You're a composer as well as arranger.
Yeah. No, I have written some piece, but you will not. You have to buy that album, I think, Alena. And there is my first piece called Arve. But it's like I say, I don't want to like refer to myself necessarily as a composer, because I'm not like a trained composer. And the thing is, like, I have no intention to be that as well, because, you know, on the euphonium, I'm so trained, and especially from those years we talked about doing the fundamentals, and I still do it. I'm very, very trained on the euphonium, and sort of it, I try to like take away every like bug in my playing, you know, the classical tradition, try to like smooth everything out and like sort of camouflate your faults or what you're not so good at. But what that does to your playing, I think, is that it takes away the spontaneous expression, or like the natural, maybe kind of a raw expression that I try to come back to now. I want to play more. I don't want to be so like well shaped. I don't consider myself to be like, as a euphonium player, you're not like a classical musician in the way a violinist are. You know, because we don't have the repertoire, we don't have the knowledge, you haven't played that amount of music from the classical music history, because it doesn't exist. That repertoire doesn't exist for us. So then you have to like steal it or borrow it or transcribe it to play it. And I've done that, and I find that especially, and the thing is, like, historically, it's common to play a lot of Baroque music on euphoniums, on sonatas and stuff. But that's like sort of a, I would say more people will probably like don't agree with me on this, but I will say like that's a very like easy style to get into. It doesn't really take so much deep musicality. Like for me, it's like the romantic repertoire that really show for me if you are a classical musician or not, to play some songs, Lieder, or yeah, you know, I done the Rococo variation, even though that's in an older style, you still play it very romantically. It's played very romantically. So, so like that school is like very necessary to be a classical musician. But even if I listen a lot to orchestra musician, it's like I don't know the repertoire the way you know it when you played it for, yeah, as you 30 years. So I usually don't identify so much as a classical musician, and often when I talk to people, I feel like I have more the same way of seeing things like jazz musicians. I have like more mindset like them, and when it comes to like composing again, sorry, I am getting out of the going in different directions, but for the composing, like I wanted that to be just me. I don't want a teacher to come and tell me how I'm going to compose. Mm-hmm. I just want it to be spontaneous. I don't want to learn about everything I do wrong, because that will just have to be my music. Because that's why I compose, is because I want to, this is what I think this is nice. It doesn't have to be in a style, and I'm not, definitely not writing contemporary music. I'm just writing music I felt that I wanted to do in the moment.
I enjoyed your November Frost for tuba euphonium quartet. I heard that on YouTube.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and that was like something I wrote, probably that took me 20 minutes, because it was like this morning I woke up and it was November and we didn't have any snow yet, and it was so cold and it had been raining, and then everything was freezing, so it was like this big frost, and it was like iced around every leaves, you know, on every like grass and everything. So it was very very nice landscape, and I felt I wanted to capture that feeling I had when I saw it outside in the forest, and that's what I tried. And for me, it's like I said, I started on the piano, so, and I didn't start on classical piano. I played like with chords, so that's what I still do. And example for that is like I have my grandfather's piano here in my house, and I can sit down on the piano and I can improvise, and I can't on a pretty okay level, and I can't do that on the euphonium.
Really?
And yeah, I mean, that tells a lot about like what I'm talking about. As a classical trained musician, it takes away the spontaneous way of playing the horn.
Yeah.
Or like I can like sort of improvise when I on the euphonium, but I catch myself like after 3 seconds thinking about what key I am in, like what scales I'm playing now, what I'm going to do next. Like that turns on automatically. On the piano, I'm just doing. And that's the same with composing. So I don't want anybody to touch that because I want to leave it, because I sort of missed that way when I started at the academy on my bachelor. It was like my teacher was like, you can't do that, you can't do that, you can't do that to me. So he like took away all of that spontaneous things in my euphonium playing. And when I was done before my final concert after my bachelor, 4-year bachelor, he said like, now you need to like bring it back. Now we need to like just play with expression. And it was so, and I spent 4 years taking it off, you know. So I think that is what classical training can do to you if you're not like have a very, very smart teacher that can really like guide you wisely through this process. And it makes, and I see that a lot, and I have a lot of friends also that are developing some kind of, almost like getting scared of their instrument because they are so afraid of doing anything wrong. Yeah. And then we're back to like this perfection again, this illusion about the perfect thing. And I also think all this comes down to audition prepping as well, because everybody that like, I don't know if it's like that this in Canada, but like the majority of people starting music education here in Norway in the performance degree wants to get in to any ensemble, like a military band or an orchestra. And the fact is, like, I think it's like 6 or 7% that actually get that kind of job. So it's like, what is the rest going to do? If only thing you know is the same rep, the same excerpts, and you're a bit scared of your instrument. It's like, it's going to be a rough life. So I think, yeah, I think we need to like, in my perspective, we need to like change music and education. And I can't talk for any other instruments than my own, honestly, but I can see the tendency in the brass community in general that this is like a thing. It's not good. And I think maybe, I know I can talk a bit about the US because I know that college system, since I've been there a lot touring and teaching, and I found that that is better when it comes to this because there is more room for not being so conservative. I don't think the orchestra and the military bands are so dominating in the schools as they are here in Scandinavia or maybe in Europe in general. And I think the reason maybe is because in Europe we have very, very few full-time brass teachers. And in Norway, I only think we have like one horn professor that is full-time, and that is everything we have in the entire country. All the rest is like part-time. And that means the teachers at the schools are orchestra musicians, just working small positions in schools. It's a good thing about that because your teacher is a very active performer and very into that. But on the other hand, it's like your teacher is not present at the school and your teachers are very focused on that only way of performing. And for me, that was a really breakthrough in my career when I realized that because up until maybe, I think, it's about 10 years ago since I took the last audition in a military band in Norway. And then I was in the final round and I didn't get the job, but they told me I had the most musical audition. And then I was like, okay, but you didn't wanted the person with the most musical audition. And then it was... sort of I was starting to think like, okay, what is this business? And I also realized that I wasn't playing after my own standard. I was playing after somebody else's standard because I wanted somebody else to like my playing because I wanted them to give me a job. And I honestly think that that moment was also the first time that I started to realize that it's not necessary about being the best. It's so many things that also, unfortunately, affects like how your career will be or what kind of chances you will get. Sometimes it's not enough to be best because they know somebody or like somebody else better as a person. And then it's like not something you can control. So that's also when I decided that, okay, I want to like have a career and have a life that I can be in charge of, I can control. And like, how can I develop that? And yeah, here I am. And of course, it's like, it's been a wild ride and I've been working so hard. I don't think people have a clue, honestly. And how many hours of practice, how many hours of administrations and contacts and everything. But also, like, people will like you if you're nice and you answer emails. I think that's important to say. So, yeah.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. I wanted to let you know about some other episodes I've linked directly to this one, with Catherine Needleman, trombonists Hilary Sims, Naomi Moon Siegel, and Douglas Burden, and trumpet players Karen Donnelly, Stephen Burns, and Chuck Kopanis. It's a joy to be able to bring these meaningful conversations to you, but this project costs me quite a bit of money and lots of time. Please support this series through either my merchandise store or on my Ko-fi page. You'll find the links in the show notes. For the merch, it features a unique design by artist Steffi Kelly, and you can browse clothes, notebooks, mugs, and more, everything printed on demand. On my Ko-fi page, you can buy me one coffee or every month. You'll also find the link to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get access to exclusive information about upcoming guests. Finally, if you're finding this episode interesting, please text it to a friend. Thanks so much.
Like on your first album, you have this composition with Fixed Media, and it has these, is it an acronym, DSDHT? What is that?
That's written by a Norwegian composer named Rune Rebne in collaboration with a Swedish computer engineer called Ludvig L. Blaus. A compressed way of saying Den største dårlighet, which is the name of the Norwegian folk song the entire piece is based out of.
Oh, okay.
Dusht, it will be. I pronounce it dusht. So it's a very, very cool piece. I like to pick it up and play it, once in a while still. I played it last fall in Italy, and I will bring it to the US in 2026, I think. And I'm doing a pretty big solo tour then. So, that will be cool.
So you're your own manager.
Yeah, I do everything. I have a manager in the US that helps me set up things there. Mm-hmm. That helps a lot, and especially also because even though I have this artist visa and stuff, it's still very, very hard for schools in US to like get an invoice for me or just mm-hmm. do a wire transfer and stuff. So everything goes through a manager. That's so much easier there. So yeah, in Europe it's like very, very nice because the European Union, even Norway is not a member of the European Union, we have almost the same agreement with them. So you can like work and travel. It's allowed to work and travel in all the countries, and like, yeah, very easy, free bank transfers and everything. So it's super easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very hard for Canadians because our country's so big, it's so expensive to travel within our country. And it's, of course, but before we had the present troubles, even to go to the States, it's very expensive for the visas and all that to work there. So it's quite, and you know, to go anywhere else, like we're so isolated in this huge country to get to Europe or.
Yeah, it was quite a process and a lot of money to get a US visa. Mm-hmm. And I saw, I also like, I really would like to come to Canada, but I also saw it's like, it will be the same process there. To like get there to work, and yeah, so it's it's a lot of money and a lot of effort.
Now you're in a duo with an American tuba player, David Earl.
Yes.
And you did a recent tour with him, and you had an opportunity to visit the Grand Canyon, which is one of these places I've always wanted to go. What was that like?
You know, sometimes Americans or like things in the US, I feel it's like a bit hyped, honestly. But to say it was, the Grand Canyon was beyond my expectations. It was unbelievable. It's like, it's a must see. Yeah. It's like, and I feel like to experience like great nature and like those kind of wow experiences, like that change you as a human. And you know, early in music history as well, like the arts and like the experience of nature were really closely connected, and it was saying they were like the same kind of experience, like an aesthetic experience. And I can really say it was that to me. Yeah, so that was really, really amazing. Absolutely. So now the Northern Lights duo, we've been going for I think we are like 7 years now, or 8 years, and yeah, still going strong. Dave is coming here in June, and we are playing a few concerts, and I'm he will be with me on the sort of pilot edition of my festival that I will try to start in my hometown, Rendalen Lowbrow Seminar.
Yeah, that's a wonderful initiative. So where do you see this going in the future as you develop it more?
No, I like to have what we call in Norwegian hairy goals, meaning that, yeah, really, really big goals. So I want to like bring world-class low brass players to my hometown every summer, and hopefully we'll bring the entire world-class brass environment in Norway, and after a while Scandinavia there. And it will be like develop into a week-long festival. For now, it will be like two concerts and one day with the seminar for the participants, but have to start small. And my goal, my plan was initially to start next year, but then like Dave had a possibility to come here, and then I said, okay, let's do it, let's just start it now, so we'll see how it goes. And yeah, so it's like a thing I'm planning to like continue doing every year until I retire. So we'll see.
But do you live in Oslo now, or you live in Rendalen?
No, I live in Drammen. It's a small town outside Oslo, so about 35 minutes drive from Oslo, downtown Oslo. So mm-hmm. basically Oslo, I would say. Yeah. So it's like, I don't know about Canadians, what is a long drive for you, but as Norwegian, we don't like to drive so long. So it's around 4 hours to Rendalen, where I grew up. And that's considered to be a long drive, very long drive in Norway.
Yeah, not here. But I was just curious if you had, it would have made more sense to me to do the seminar in Oslo just for transportation.
Yeah, but this is like, this is my hometown. Like, as I said, it's a very, very small place. Now it lives like 1,800 people there. And I really have my heart there for this place. And this is like sort of, I want to like give something back. What can I do? I can sort of, what can I put my help with? And the actual thing is as well as it's very, very beautiful in the summer. And it's very, it's not located with the coast. So we don't have the fjords, but we sure have mountains and pretty easy access. And it's possible to get some pretty spectacular hiking without walking for 8 hours. So my plan after a while is to like include some hiking, maybe include some bike and a boat experience on lakes, and yeah, traditional food, yeah, to include that. So it's sort of more like a culture thing as well. So it will be like a package that can also like help the general tourism and like other small businesses in Rendalen. That is what I hope. So yeah, we have to see and we have to get some support and it will develop. Yeah, but I think I'm optimistic. I think this will be realistic. I have a great network, like people has already asked like, can I come? So some pretty big names. So I think it will be very easy to get some big names there. It will be in the beginning probably harder to get participants. So, but we'll see. We'll see. This will probably not be so big this summer. But yeah, you have to build it stone by stone, like as you have to do with your playing. I think it's like, and that is all often forgotten. Is like if you want to like build something really good, not just playing, but if it's an ensemble or a festival or like a network or whatever, it's like you have to be committed, and it's like consistency is the key, and don't give up. It's like I often get asked by people like, what is the trick? Have you come to the place where you are? And the only answer I can say is like, I have not given up. I just worked hard over time and tried to be nice and honest. That's all. It's like I just didn't give up. I have this very cool, this one.
A winner is just a loser who tried one more time. Who says that? I don't see the author.
George M. Moore Jr. I don't know who that is. Maybe you know.
I don't, but I'm sure some listeners will.
Yeah. But it's a very, very good one.
I mean, if when you look back at 10 years ago when you didn't win that job you wanted, how your life would have been relatively boring compared to where it is now.
Yeah. I'm very happy I didn't got that job.
Do you want to talk to David? Is there like a duo clip we could include and point people towards?
I have some things on my YouTube channel, a few things there. So you can just pick if you want something. I think I have an arrangement I made actually called the Norwegian Folk Tunes or something that is pretty good.
This clip of a live performance of Norwegian folk tunes arranged by Benta is performed by the Northern Lights duo with David Earle. The video is linked in the full show notes on my website.
Thank you.
So in terms of inclusion in the low brass world, I know you had a recent decision that you were very public about not to attend the recent International Tuba and Euphonium Conference in Spain.
Yeah, and this is part of what I said earlier about about like I spend a lot of time on like figure out why I didn't fit in, and after a while I figured out this was because I was not included. And that is not included like people are saying you are not allowed to be here included, but just the feeling that, you know, if you go out with someone and have a drink or something, and then you everybody's saying goodbye and you get a feeling the rest of the group are just going to the next pub and you are, they just want to send you home, like that kind of exclusion. And also I recently read or like started to read a bit about gender theory, and then I realized that that feeling of not belonging is also about how we are taught and raised. And it's like, as a low brass player, euphonium player, I only heard about men that play the euphonium, men that are great. And that was until I like by myself discovered Gail Robertson and Laura Leinberger in the US, and they also, like the first time I met them at that IWBC in 2017, they were like so warm and inclusive, and they automatically welcomed me, and then I felt like wow. And I think honestly that was the first time I met some euphonium players that I felt I could trust. And but about the conference, it's like over the last year, and you mentioned Catherine Needleman, and she's tried to bring awareness to some decisions being made by the ITEA, International Tuba Euphonium Association, and questioned some actions from the leadership in that organization. And I totally support Catherine on that, and I reacted very strongly on how the leadership responded to her, because there were no willingness to go into a discussion. They were just like saying, I will not discuss this. And for me, that is like breaking one of the fundamental things about living in a democracy or being a democratic organization. And that is that every voice shall be heard. And the goal is not to agree on everything. There is no like one way, but it's room for different opinions. For me, that is the democracy, basically, summed up. And that's what we live in, and that's what that kind of organization is. And I also was at a festival in Brazil in November. First time for me in Brazil. Great. Was a very emotional and a really eye-opener experience for me to go there and also see all the joy and the great community they are building there on low brass. Some extremely dedicated people are doing terrific work there. And then I also met up with some people from the leadership of the ITEA, and we're having like a big discussion with them. And then I realized that from my point of view, I didn't see any will to from them to change, or like to say, to admit that they maybe did a mistake. And I said to them that I will not come and contribute to anything before we get an apology, because earlier they were like saying that, for example, there came a public statement from the ITEA saying that everything is really good when it comes to gender equality here in Norway, that we don't have any problem on the low brass scene. And being a low brass player female in Norway, having several low brass player friends female in Norway that has also stopped playing because of how things are, I found that very strange. And that either you are closing your eyes and don't want to admit it, or otherwise you don't really care, you're not really aware. So I don't know what's really the case. But anyway, I felt when I got got that question to go and play in Valencia, where everybody will be, I assume, the entire Tuba Euphonium community except me will probably be there. When I saw the email and I went to bed that night and then I woke up at 2 and I was like immediately sure that my body just told me, you can't go. If you go there, you will not be able to look yourself in the mirror. It's like, it's more important for me to be true to my values than to than to go and have, play a big gig. Because, and then I gotten some critique about it, like, yeah, why don't you just go and play awesome and then they will like understand. But honestly, that's what all the generations before me have done. And there, that been, and history has shown it doesn't work. It's not enough to just show up and play well. That doesn't change it. The men's club or the boys' clubs are still there or whatever it is. It's not necessarily a gender thing. It's about power abuse and not leaving room to people that don't agree with you when it comes to performance practice or pedagogic. And that is like a shame, because that means that we are lacking that diversity. And what arts needs is diversity if you want to make progress. And especially for Tuba Euphonium, it's like we are like this tiny, tiny, tiny community, and people are obsessed about themselves and what they are doing. And it's very, very strange, because in reality, it's like we should all focus on like getting our instrument out there to a bigger crowd. And yeah, every time I raised my voice and told that to the IT, it's like they are only interested in just hosting their conferences and doing the same thing instead of like, okay, maybe we should actually invite ourselves to go to a violin conference or something, you know, to just, maybe we can like commission music to like, that will open some other possibilities for us, you know, think very differently. I haven't like heard or seen any kind of initiative like that. And I think it's like, I think the reason is because some people benefit from status quo. Some people benefits a lot, oh, that things remains the same. And that is the people with power that have come to power now. And they don't want to change, because that will take something from them. They just wanted to remain the same way. And I think this is also maybe a bit of a struggle we are facing in the low brass world also for women, is that the few women that has succeed has not always been very inclusive to new generations. And that is a problem. As I said, like Laura and Gail has been super inclusive to me. So I'm like very lucky, and I'm trying to be that to younger player as well, because I feel it's my responsibility. It's like Laura and Gail made it a bit easier for me. And I hopefully will make it a bit easier for the next generation. But still, it's like some people that have very high position in the brass community, females, are still don't want to like let go of their position. They seems like they want to be the only one, you know? So that's also a big problem. And I think maybe this is what power does to you. And that is also what I really like about. I sometimes joke, especially when I go to the US and teach and play, because I don't have a doctorate, you know, because it's not very common to have that in Europe. And I don't really have a job. So I usually tell them that I'm undereducated and I don't have a job. So because it's like, and that makes you also very free position, and you feel like you can speak up without risking anything. I think that's a big problem, because people will not speak up. I have so many private conversations with people that are really upset about the situation, but they are not speaking up, because it will make their work situation much harder. Mm-hmm. And that's really a shame. But at least I felt I'm in a position to where I can speak up, and I don't think it alone will change anything, but at least it was good for me to like say it, and it seemed that a lot of people noticed it. It got a lot of attention on social media. So, yeah, we'll see. Maybe they will reach out to me at some point, and maybe they will do a public excuse that they put their words in a very unnecessary way, I will say. Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit more about Catherine's commission from Kairis for you to perform the new piece?
Yeah. Yeah, because that was also a piece that came together after, yeah, I would say some very heavy interaction between Catherine Neilman and a great euphonium star, and a big disagreement. And they were planning to have like an online conversation that people could like pay to watch and listen to, and the money from that was fundraising for a new piece for euphonium and piano. And I was asked by Catherine if I wanted to do the premiere, and of course I wanted that, on the same time knowing that that will make me an enemy to some very big names on my instrument. But still, I felt it was very easy for me to say yes, because again, I felt it was a morally right thing to do. And also, I'm very interested in doing new music. And we got a really nice piece from Paris. They did a great job. So yeah, I'm looking forward to perform it again and hopefully record it. And I think it's written in a style that I think it's a bit new for the euphonium repertoire. So it's, you know, it's very, sometimes very hard to get to write music and make it sound new, to like have some innovation in it. But I think Kairis has managed that, and it will be, I'm looking forward also to follow Kairis' career in the future, both as a flutist and a composer, and excited for what they will do.
Yeah. We talked a little bit about teaching before, and I was, and you know, you mentioned about over practicing and fundamentals, and certainly in your online masterclasses, you go over specifics about embouchure. So people have probably seen that who are interested, but I was curious about the angle of encouraging creativity and expression from day one with students. So you do quite a bit of online teaching as well as in person. So what kind of things do you do to foster that with your students?
Oh, that's a big question. When I was in my master's, I had to spend a lot of time, or I spent a lot of time recording myself. And I did it in the way, like, I've always been like a morning person. So I got into school very early, and then there were always like some good rooms available so we can reserve it. And then I stayed maybe for 5 or 6 hours or in a room, and where I practiced and where I recorded, and I immediately listened back. And the reason I did it was because I realized that I had to make my brain and ears have realistic, being able to like really hear what I'm doing. Because, you know, your brain thinks you are doing so much more than what you're really doing. So I needed that to be more on track. And as I tell my students now, it's like still not on track. And that's why I record myself still, and that's why I have an Instagram profile recording. It's not because I want to upload stuff, because I actually use it in my practice. It's like those videos are more for me than for my Instagram followers, really. It's like I'm not, you understand what I'm saying? I'm not creating content. I'm using the things I am actually doing for myself. to really like have people understand that, because I think this is the big hurdle for a lot of people, and I think like to train yourself to like what do you really hear when you hear, and what do you really hear when you listen to your own practice, and to raise that awareness. And it's like often I do this just small test with students. It's like I ask them to close their eyes for like 10-15 seconds, and then I say, okay, we're going to listen to all the sounds around us now, and you're going to tell me, count how many different sounds you could hear. And usually I find myself hearing 2 or 3 more sounds than all the students every time. And I think that's like, what do you really hear? And I think for and that's kind of a quality I try to implement in my playing, is like really are you really like playing in the center of the notes? Like, how is your legato? Can it be better? It's like, how are you really shaping? How are you coloring this note? Like, how expressive is this playing really? And I constantly try to push myself on that every day in my practice and really have that kind of awareness, you know, that kind of, I often say that like my practice room is my research lab. That's what it really is. And I try to, for the students, it's like, I don't think this is really something you can learn. You can just, or like learn people in the way to like tell them. But you can, as a teacher, you can just encourage them to do it and try to make them understand why they should do this and like commit to this way of practice. And that's why I feel it's like, I'm feeling real bad when I say it, but I almost never listen to euphonium music anymore. And it's like, I can listen to maybe like 5 bars. And I'm not saying that I am better. Maybe people have the same, will say the same about my playing. I listened 5 bars and then it was so boring. I didn't want to listen anymore. But because I feel it's like, I hear a lot of, and this is not only euphonium, but in general, I hear a lot of music being played, especially classical music, that I don't believe. Like, you have to play in a way to make people believe you. And the first step of making other people believe in your playing is you have to believe it yourself. And then you have to do this kind of mental process, or like not mental, but intellectual process, like understanding the piece. And I feel, again, a lot of students these days are so in a hurry. They just want to play it. And they don't really care how it sounds. It's just like, click it off, put it on my resume that I have played this piece with an orchestra, I have done this recital. It's more important to do stuff than do stuff with quality. And of course, I feel that same way with myself and my performances, but I'm an adult, like I need to make money. And sometimes I have to do gigs to make money. And I wish, like I'm thinking so many times, like at least once a week, I'm thinking like, oh, when I was a student, like, and you had like one recital every 6 months and you could like spend 6 months on a repertoire. And now I'm like, this last month, I was playing like 2 big solo recitals with 1 hour program. And it was only one piece that was the same. And it was like with 8 days between those recitals. And that's the reality. And then sometimes you don't get everything up to the level you really want, but to have that kind of commitment to like always go for the quality and like push yourself and don't, again, I said like I stopped playing after other people's standards and I find my own, and like I'm like, I often think like I will never come to the place where I'm happy, you know, with my playing. I will probably die before I reach that level, because it's like it's a lifelong process, and it's like it's so much to learn on this instrument just standing behind my back. And it's like I am so far away from reaching this instrument's potential. I'm not even close. It's so much left. And yeah, I'm not sure I'm going to make it like to a level that I'm really satisfied with. It's like, and I feel it's like that's kind of the development, and it's like a constant thing. It's like I don't practice to like keep the level. I practice to become better, and hopefully I will maybe be able to have progress, if I'm lucky, maybe 8-10 years more of progress before I have to like settle on just keeping the level. And I think that's the drive. And that's the drive of being an artist, I think. It's like, it's not, like historically you can say artist had very like unhappy life. But I think the goal is to, when you're done with your practice for the day, you leave it and then you go on and have a life. And just separate those two things. I tell that to student a lot. You need to be very hard on yourself in the practice room, and that's rough. And I was so hard on myself in the practice room when I was a student, and I still am. And I still have the same process, like 2 weeks before or 2 weeks before a big concert, I feel super confident. 1 week before a big concert, I'm doubting myself. I feel I haven't done the job. I like going through all those processes. Is my sound really okay? Is this good enough? Will people like it? It's the same thing. It will never go away. But that's the part of like being able to perform well. You need to have that kind of, if you're just saying to yourself like, I'm super happy, I'm good, then I don't think you will reach your full potential. You need to feel, it's like, you know, no pain, no gain. That's simple.
I'm curious, for your self-reflection, do you use like journaling? Do you write down ideas or for planning or dreaming about things?
Yeah, I have this. I don't think I could live without that book now. It's not like very detailed, but I write down stuff to get it out of my head so I'm not stressed because I have to remember stuff. Because I realize that, so it can be like anything. It can be very like administrative, boring stuff, but it can also be like artistic ideas. And what I do very often is like I just use my phone, and whenever I come up with something on the euphonium or the piano or just with my voice, I immediately record it. So I have like a lot of like small 20, 30 seconds of me singing or playing something that I might want to use in a piece in the future. Mm. So I take time to get those ideas out immediately. Last year I wrote a euphonium concerto that I premiered with my hometown orchestra in Rendalen in Christmas, last Christmas. And that piece was made entirely like out of me having like 1.5 years with small teams on my phone. And it took me like 14 days to make that into a 26-minute euphonium concerto. Just put it in writing it out. But then everything has gone, just been in my head. And I found that that's the way to really also be creative for me. It's like I want to have things. I want to know it very like far. So I can plan it very like far ahead. I'm not like working on it, but it's just there. And then I realized more and more that suddenly it will click. It will come to you. And the more time you have, the longer perspective, the higher chance that you will come up with something that is quite good. Just like leave it there. But yeah. So yeah. But I also think I'm very lucky. You know, school and everything has always been very easy for me. Like writing or speaking, not English but Norwegian, and I'm quite like quick to understand and learn stuff like theoretically, I think I'm like, and I have a very good short-term memory, so I survive a lot on that, and I try to stay pretty healthy. So when I'm working a lot, for example, I don't drink alcohol. I only try to do that only when I have time off. So in long periods, I don't drink at all. And I very prioritize sleeping a lot and resting. And I try to exercise. I run. I'm not fast runner or anything. I like food, so I'm a bit overweight, so I don't run very fast, but I run almost every day because it's like good for mental capacity, but also I think it's crucial for me personal. My size, playing the instrument I do, is very physical demanding, so I need to be in a decent shape. And especially now I'm like 41 year old, and I need to like also do some strength training, and I need to do that in able to like play these instruments without getting any injuries.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for this today. Really appreciated this chance to sit down and talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support the series, that would be wonderful. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. All the links are in the show notes. The podcast theme music was written by Nick Cold. Have a wonderful week.